It's The Splendid Table from APM, American Public Media. I'm Lynn Rossetto Casper. I was looking at refrigerators online, and I came across this wild thing designed by a Russian student. It's a gel refrigerator. Now, this is what it looks like. Imagine a tall mirror in a brushed steel frame, but it's about 4 inches thick, and it's leaning against the wall. Now, the frame holds a door-sized sheet of green gel. You push anything into the gel, any food, it stays and it chills. And the gel senses exactly the temperature that that particular food needs, and you can see the food in the gel. Take it out, the food's clean, and the gel looks like nothing's touched it. One other thing, you can mount the fridge vertically, horizontally, or on the ceiling. But you have to have patience. The gel fridge doesn't come out until 2050. Stay with us for more this hour on The Splendid Table. This is The Splendid Table from APM, American Public Media, the show about life's appetites. I'm Lynn Rossetto Casper. Certain restaurants are talked about in hushed tones. Their food's always exquisite, but more important is that everyone who comes through their doors leaves feeling special. New York's Danielle has been one of these since Danielle Ballou, a French chef from Lyon, opened it 20 years ago. Now, this isn't an easy accomplishment, especially when you have 14 other restaurants around the world. Danielle's always had an eerie, intuitive sense of what Americans want in their French food. But what happens to his food when a chef, rigidly trained in classical French tradition, has cooked longer in his new country than in his homeland? Well, Danielle is out with a new book, a coffee table mammoth called Danielle, My French Cuisine. Well, his longtime friend and collaborator on one of his previous books is Dori Greenspan. She's a best-selling author in her own right. Well, we asked these two to sit down together and talk.
Hi, Danielle. It's so good to see you.
Hello, Dori.
You know, this is pretty drastic for us to be in the studio together. It's the only way I get to see you lately.
No, I know.
I love, love, love the new book. And, you know, I know all of your books. This one has a very different, very special feel to it. Talk to me about it. What inspired it? What does it mean to you?
Well, we're celebrating Restaurant Danielle 20 years anniversary, and that means
déjà,
for me,
already.
Déjà, 20 years. And I wanted to do it capturing the moment today, but recapturing also some moment in my life as a chef. I have done wonderful dishes besides the dishes I put in the menu at Danielle over the year. I've done wonderful dishes I've never really made public, or I never had a chance to really practice too much with it. And I wanted to talk about iconic French dishes, or at least what I feel is iconic to me.
Okay, so the book has the recipes from Danielle.
Restaurant Danielle.
It has the iconic recipes.
Absolutely.
It has essays.
Yes.
From
Bill Buford. Mm-hmm.
Well, but also
essays,
from you.
Essays on wine, essays on cheese, essays on bread. All the things would touch the experience at Danielle.
And then it has Danielle at home.
Because I live right above the store. And so I felt it'd be nice to not lie about it and be, this is part of my life. This book is kind of my living presence as a chef.
Okay, so you've been in America longer than you've been in France,
it's
right?
It's true.
Being here 30 years, how do you stay French?
Well, I'm very lucky to be in New York. And I think in New York, it don't matter where you come from, you always remain very attached to your roots and to your community. And basically, for me, French cuisine has always been part of my DNA. And while I have definitely grown as an American chef here, I was born to be a cook in France.
So this makes me think of this amazing section in your book, the part I so love, that has iconic dishes. And these are dishes almost historical, can we say that?
Yeah. And I was very lucky 5 years ago to meet Bill Bruford.
Who's the writer for, he writes for The New Yorker, and he wrote that great book, Heat.
Absolutely. And Bill decided to go to France and experience French cuisine in France and become an apprentice and live his life in France for the last 4 years. And I wanted to spend a moment with Bill after this period he spent in France and say, why don't you come to New York and we cook together? And something might come out of it. If you inspire, you write about it. If you are not, then we'll never talk about it. And I think, iconic was kind of a difficult word. We felt like Bill was feeling like maybe iconic is not the right thing. And then as more, when you read the origin of iconic, it's a person or a thing regarded as a representative symbol of something. And for me, making those dishes was the representation of my upbringing as a young cook, my passion for French cuisine, and definitely my admiration for the history of French cuisine.
Okay, so this is why I think you are the only person I know, at least, who could have done this, because each of these dishes, as we look at them, look like something from a beautiful, old, illustrated cookbook from centuries ago.
Yes.
And yet you have a personal attachment to each of
these. Very much, because every one of the recipe touched me in one part of my life as a chef. For example, turbo soufflé was inspired by a sol soufflé I was doing in Nandron when I was 14 years old, 15 years old.
Okay, take just a second to tell us what the components of this dish
are. Well, the turbo soufflé, we take about a 12-pound turbo, which cost a fortune. And turbo is a flat fish, which is about, I would say, about 3-inch thick, and it was about 18-inch long. And there is a special braising pan called turbotière to prepare that dish. And so we basically carve out the filet and remove the bones and stuff it with lobster and basil and tomato and a little soufflé mousse of turbo as well, and decorate it with tomatoes and chive, black olive, and zucchini in a very
almost like a mosaic. It's
mosaic
beautiful
pattern. And I wanted to take it to something a little bit more Mediterranean with tomato and basil and olive and artichokes and the whole turbo stuffed with lobster.
So you played around with an icon.
Yes, and it took hours and hours to make it, but it was an amazing session.
Okay, so let's finish with one dish that we can make at home for ourselves.
Ah, I think for our home dishes, the chicken fricassee with vinegar, tomato, and tarragon.
Mm, I love that dish.
I always love to do a one-pot meal, and this is the ultimate one-pot meal when you start by roasting your chicken with shallots and tarragon, and then you add up the tomatoes, and we deglaze that with vinegar and let it stew gently. It's delicious, and it's something so Lyonnais, so Lyon. The poulet au vinaigre.
So we can take a piece of Restaurant Daniel home with us. Thank you so much.
You're welcome, Dory.
Chef Daniel Ballou's book is Daniel, My French Cuisine. Dory Greenspan is author of the best-selling Around My French Table. Daniel left us with a recipe for that chicken fricassee. It is called Poulet with Tarragon. Find it on the website splendidtable.org. It was the 1970s. Two East Coast college kids had a map of the United States, a VW bus, and a free summer. Well, the country wasn't all that big on the map, so how hard would it be to go to every state and find the best local places to eat? Well, those kids were Jane and Michael Stern. And believe it or not, they pulled it off. Roadfood.com was born. Hey, you two. Good to have you back. And where have you been?
Everywhere.
We have been eating meat.
red meat everywhere we can possibly get it. And one of the things that occurred to us is that, you know, while the chain steakhouses are ubiquitous, and they're good if you have the money, like, you know, Morton's and
Ruth's Chris
and so forth. There are a lot of really wonderful non-chain steakhouses around the country. I mean, great, great old-style restaurants that are nothing like the chains in a lot of ways.
That used to be, and I think still is in a lot of the country, really a very individual kind of place, and it's a very special kind of place.
They still are. It's the place where you go Friday or Saturday night and you have an old-fashioned or a cocktail, and maybe even at some of them there's supper clubs and you can do a little dancing. But places like the Tea Steakhouse in T-E-A, South Dakota – are really out of the 1940s, and the food is wonderful, and the ambiance is nothing like a chain steakhouse.
And in fact, we have a souvenir matchbook from the Tea Steakhouse that says, "Bring your sugar to tea."
What's this place like?
It looks like kind of an old roadhouse. I mean, it's there's a lot of wood. There are booths. It's very South Dakotian.
Nothing like an expense account style steakhouse. You don't see anyone dressed in their business suits. I mean, people dress pretty casually, but this is the big deal meal. And of course, you know, you get either the filet mignon, which comes wrapped in bacon, which it really doesn't need. It's juicy enough. Or the strip steak, some really good hash browns on the side, and as Jane said, a nice highball to begin the meal.
You know, I think, though, if you want to talk ambiance, Doe's Eat Place in Greenville, Mississippi might be my favorite one. Have you been there, Lynn?
No, but you guys have talked about this place before.
Yeah. It's in the Mississippi Delta, and it's like eating in somebody's kitchen.
Well, you're eating in the restaurant's kitchen.
That's
is what
true.
You're eating.
It's little with formica tables.
And you're surrounded by stoves and places where they're slicing onions to make fried onions, and they're mixing the salad at a table nearby, and everything is mismatched. And the steaks, even though Dos Cigna swore to us that he just goes to the local supermarket and buys choice steaks, I don't believe him because these are sensationally
They are sensational.
Good steaks. And another one where we were just recently is the Cattleman Steakhouse in Oklahoma City, which is literally in the heart of the stockyards. And one of the things that's cool about that place is they open at 6 a.m. because people who work in the stockyards still go there. And you can go there and have a fabulous breakfast steak or brains and eggs if that's how you want to start your meal.
And I do have to give a nod to the upscale steakhouses, the singular ones. In Chicago, I mean, absolutely, Harry Carey's and Gene and Giorgetti. Probably Gene and Giorgetti is one of my favorite places to eat ever anywhere. And if you're not a carnivore, the shrimp Dijon is probably the greatest Chicago dish going.
What is shrimp Dijon?
Oh, you don't know what that
That's is? That's a unique Chicago dish. It goes back to the early part of the 20th century. It's basically shrimp cosseted in breadcrumbs with a lot of sherry and garlic, and it's baked.
Oh,
and it's a real old-fashioned kind of casserole, but if the shrimp are good, it's sensational.
Sensational.
Oh, boy. Hey, thank you both. Great tour.
Bye, Lynn.
Bye-bye. Bye.
Jane and Michael Stern are the creators of roadfood.com. For their latest dining picks, check out the website splendidtable.org. And while you're there, be sure to check all of our projects, podcasts, our giant recipe box, and our new collection of ebooks, Eating In with Lynn. It's all there, splendidtable.org. Now we're going to be back with the panic and pleasure of candy and a user's guide to coconut oil. I'm Lynn Rossetto Casper. You're listening to The Splendid Table from APM, American Public Media. This is The Splendid Table from APM, American Public Media, the show about life's appetites. I'm Lynn Rossetto Casper. Since high candy eating season is upon us, I have a question for you. What's the difference between a Snickers bar and a Fiber One chocolate bar? Well, one we see as candy and the other we see as food. Candy's often demonized, even though supposedly it supplies only 10% of the added sugar that ends up in our diets. The fiber bar could have as much sugar, chemicals, and fat as a candy bar, but we judge these two differently. Well, this is the interesting premise behind a new book by Rutgers University Professor Emerita Samira Kawash. It's called Candy, A Century of Panic and Pleasure. Samira, welcome.
Thank you. It's great to be here.
So you have the word panic in your title, pleasure and panic. What are you talking about?
Well, I think the panic first occurred to me as a new mother. My daughter at that time was about 3 years old, and me and all of my mommy friends were beginning to realize that our kids knew about candy, and we needed to decide if we were going to let them eat it. Well, my daughter ate some jelly beans. She really liked them. She wanted to share them with her friend. I took them over to her friend's house. We offered them, and I said to her mother, "Is it okay if your little boy has these jelly beans?" And she said, "Well, I suppose it couldn't harm." And I said, "Harm? Gee, hmm." And then the father kind of chimes in and says, "Huh, so you're going to be giving him crack soon, I guess." And I was like, "Wow, crack? I mean, it's just jelly beans, really?" And I thought about it, and I was like, you know, even though it was an extreme reaction and I felt really uncomfortable about the fact that I had brought these jelly beans into the room, it wasn't the first time I'd heard something like that, that you know, especially around young children, that there was something really harmful and dangerous about candy. And candy in a very specific way, because these same mommies who were very worried about their children's access to candy were handing over the juice boxes with no problem at all. And I'm looking at my five jelly beans, and that's a little sugar. And I'm looking at the juice box, and that's a little sugar. And I'm thinking, you know, really, it's not that different. Why is it that those brightly colored, shiny jelly beans seem to speak of something much more complicated and much more potentially dangerous than the same sugar and the same substances that are in a different kind of form that might be related to apples, let's say?
Well, you know, the first thing that comes to mind is candy, it was never meant to be any kind of nutritional element. The juice box, well, you could say there's vitamins in there and that kind of thing.
Yeah. Well, the thing that I started thinking about is, you know, candy itself has its own story. And where does candy come from? And how does it become something that means these complicated things to us today? And so I started digging around. I'm a researcher. And so I started doing some research. And one of the first things I did was I ran to the dictionary and looked up words for candy and confection in particular. And confectioner, that's, you know, we call a candy maker a confectioner, but it also means someone who makes medicines and poisons. And this was fascinating to think about that connection between medicine and candy. And of course, it was originally, yeah, it's the apothecaries in the pre-modern period who have the secrets of candy making. And most of the first candies were medicinal preparations. So I started researching sort of the emergence of candy from these ancient apothecaries into our own time and discovered that, not coincidentally, the very first candy machine invented in America was invented by someone working in a pharmacy. And he needed to figure out how to make his lozenges more uniform in shape and how to make them more quickly. And so he invented the first candy making machine in America, which unleashed what I call the candy big bang, the revolution in machine-made candies.
When would this have been? Middle 1800s or something
this
like that?
This was in 1847, the first candy machine. And then the Civil War came along and Americans were pretty distracted and not thinking too much about candy and machines for a little while.
Right.
But after
right.
the Civil War, all sorts of new kinds of industrial technology come into being and transform just about everything, but transform candy in particular, because now what had formerly been a very expensive and very rare treat is now it's suddenly possible to make candy in massive quantities, so that by the 1880s, candy is available all the time everywhere to most Americans living in sort of any reasonable sized city or town.
But there was a period after that, right, where candy actually becomes evil. Right?
Well,
it was like the temperance movement against candy.
Yes. Well, there were two different strands of thinking about what was dangerous about candy in the late 19th century. And one of them came out of a kind of dietary moralism that had been developing throughout the century, an idea that certain kinds of foods were good and godly and other kinds of foods were overstimulating and dangerous to the organism and were evil because they took your body and your health further away from God. And those ideas weren't about candy specifically, but when candy became more widely available, they attached to candy very easily because candy was made of sugar and sugar was one of those dangerous, overstimulating substances that might drive you to different kinds of frenzies of vice and sinfulness. At the same time, there was the growing worry about whether manufactured foods were safe or harmful. And the concern that manufactured foods were adulterated with more or less dangerous kinds of things, either fillers that were harmless or perhaps more dangerously poisons and toxins that could harm people. And candy, because it was so completely artificial, you know, it's these wild colors and unusual shapes and forms that were never found in nature, it was easy to look at candy and say, hey, that looks like some kind of food that might be very, very dangerous.
Well, to update to today, though, your premise in the book is that small amounts of candy are or a very small percentage of the added sugar that we put in our diets, but that we see candy and food as two completely different things. And that today, if you really analyze the two, they're not so different.
I think that there is a notion that there is a line of food on one side and candy on the other, and we should eat food and we shouldn't really eat too much candy. Except when you look at the food, well, at least I wonder. I just saw an ad on TV for a product called Fiber One Caramel Bar or something like that. And the picture looks like a candy bar. It's, you know, chocolate and oozing caramel and nuts and all kinds of yummy, delicious candy things. And then the tagline is something like, you don't have to worry, it's not a candy bar. And I think that urge to have food that looks and tastes and has all the pleasures of candy, but somehow is still going to be qualified as food because it has some amount of fiber or because it has added vitamins or something like that. I think that that kind of merging of processed food and manufactured food and different forms of candy seems to lay the groundwork for some very confused ideas about eating. And I think what I would like to practice in my life and what I'd like to teach my daughter is to let candy be candy, to look at candy and say, that's candy, that's a treat. But you know what? That granola bar is also candy and that fruit snack is also candy. So when you're thinking about having candy, have some candy. And when you want to have food, have food. Have the real fruit, not the fruit snack, if you will.
Interesting take. Thank you very much.
It's been my pleasure.
Samira Kawash is a Rutgers University professor emerita, creator of CandyProfessional.com, and confesses to a love-hate relationship with the sweet stuff. Well, try this recipe for buttermints from Litabit Sweets. It's on the website, splendidtable.org. Extra virgin olive oil may have had its day in the sun. Coconut oils are taking over. It's become the darling of health-conscious cooks, whether you're making a tuna casserole or a tempeh pad thai. Well, to get the lowdown, managing producer Sally Swift talked to culinary nutritionist Tricia Williams, founder of Food Matters NYC.
Hey, Tricia, thanks for joining us.
Nice to be here.
So what do we need to know when we buy coconut oil?
I think what's really important is to look for extra virgin cold-pressed coconut oil the same way you would olive oil. So this way you're seeking out the highest quality product that's out there.
And how do you use it?
Oh, my gosh, there's so many ways I love to use coconut oil. Traditional dessert recipes that use butter, I like to substitute coconut oil. I particularly like them in brownies. The chocolate and the coconut flavor together, just beautiful. And the coconut oil adds such a moisture to any kind of baking product. Banana bread is particularly great with.
And do you replace it at the same amount as you would, the exact same amount of butter
you
that's
would.
Called for?
Yeah.
Okay.
Mm-hmm.
And what about baking recipes that use vegetable oils? Can it stand
yeah,
in there?
It's an easy swap out.
Okay,
yes.
It is. And what about savory cooking?
Well, there's so many things you can do with coconut oil and savory cooking. You know, Spectrum Oils, which I don't know if you know that company, mm-hmm. they make a spray coconut oil. So if you're calorie conscious and you want to cut back, you can use the spray version. But I like to sear off wild salmon and coconut oil and top it with something like mangoes and chilies and a little cilantro and lime. And the coconut flavor on the fish is subtle, but it adds another level of richness to the salmon.
Oh, that sounds delicious.
Yeah, one of my other favorite things to do is either take butternut squash or sweet potatoes and toss them with coconut oil and cinnamon and some sea salt and roast them in the oven. coconut oil can take really high heat. So it can go up to 500 degrees before becoming unstable. So you can get some really nice high heat roasting on it.
Yeah, so you get all that sear. And can you drizzle it? Can you warm it and drizzle it like you would an olive oil over a piece of fish or over some
vegetables? You absolutely can. So you definitely need to warm it so it turns into a liquid because it remains at a solid state at room temperature. But you can certainly drizzle it, and making a warm vinaigrette is a wonderful idea.
And do you keep it in the fridge, or do you leave it out on the shelf?
If you're going through it fast enough, you can leave it out on the shelf. If you work with it directly from the fridge, it is rock hard and kind of difficult to scoop out. So my suggestion is if you do store in the fridge, to take it out probably 20 minutes before you're going to use it, and so it's easier to work with.
And what are the health benefits? And why is it, it's a solid fat, so in theory it should be a fat that's not good for us.
Right. So, it's a saturated fat, but science shows that the type of saturated fat it is, it's a medium-chain fatty acid, so it doesn't enter the body the same way, say, saturated fat from red meat would or something like that. And it's interesting that if you look at the coconut oil, it's heralded as a superfood because of all of its wonderful effects. So it's full of antioxidants. It's antimicrobial, so it's good for the immune system. Mm-hmm. And because it is a saturated fat, it really helps you stay fuller longer. So I always tell my clients that it's the type of fat that helps you lose fat. And it's a really powerful tool.
I had never even thought about that, but there is a satiation
level. I have clients who even put a teaspoon in their smoothie in the morning, and it just helps them stay fuller longer throughout the day.
Do you have some brands of coconut oil that you love to use?
So my number one favorite brand is Sun Food Nutrition. They make a cold-pressed extra virgin coconut oil. And it's interesting, we use so much of it. I even use so much of it at home. You can buy it in bulk by the 5-pound bucket from them, which is great. And then, like I said before, I really like Spectrum coconut oil spray. It's terrific for making pancakes, searing fish, whatever it is that you like to do it, we're using a smaller amount of oil.
It will be interesting to see if boutique coconut oils start popping up.
Oh, I bet you they will.
I bet they will, too. Tricia, thanks for filling us in.
You're welcome. It's a pleasure.
Nutritionist Tricia Williams does custom meals and caters through her Food Matters NYC site. Her recipe for curry coconut sweet potatoes, that's on the website, splendidtable.org. Why don't you talk to me? Why don't you talk to me? I'm standing here alone. I know you'll never phone. Why don't you talk to me? It is time to connect. We're taking your calls. You can catch up with us at 800-537-5252. And you can always find us on Facebook and Twitter. And send us an email. Go to splendidtable.org. Rifke is on the line from Lakewood, New Jersey. What's on your mind, Rifke?
Hi, Lynn. So I was listening to an episode of yours. It must have been a couple of months ago. And you had Sally Schneider sharing her key three. And one of them was herb salt.
Oh, yes, right.
And, of course, I have containers of herbs, and, the more I cut them, the more I grow, so I proceeded to make some of it, and I can't make enough of it, but I haven't really found anything to do with it other than putting some on roast capon and roast chicken, and also on roasted vegetables, and my kids have threatened to throw any more roasted things with herb salt at me, so I was wondering if you had any other suggestions for what I could do with this stuff.
Well, why don't we describe what Sally does with those herb salts? It's up on the website, but it's this idea of chopping the herbs into the salt, essentially, right? That you're blending fresh herbs and you scent the salt. Use that salt anywhere that salt is called for. So,
okay.
You're making, I'm just trying to think, you're doing a soup. And you want to get a little rosemary in there, and it needs salt. Don't add the salt that is called for in a recipe. Use the rosemary salt. Use the garlic salt. Use the salt that is made of, marjoram and ginger. You see what I'm saying?
Mm-hmm.
Use it wherever salt can go.
Mm-hmm.
And the interesting thing is, for instance, let's say you're making something like a pie crust. Why not throw
rosemary salt into a pie crust that you've sweetened very lightly that's going to go into an apple pie.
Oh, wow, that sounds amazing. We actually just picked apples a few days ago, and I have loads of apples and was planning to make an apple pie. So you would do just rosemary salt. You wouldn't put garlic, obviously, in that one. So just the rosemary and salt, and then put a little bit of it into the crust.
Right. But, remember all the salts you can make. You know, there's rosemary, there's sage, there's thyme, there's basil. And then there's the fun of the Asian herbs. What about if you ground it up really, really fine lemongrass salt?
I actually grow that.
Well, there you go. Okay. You see what I'm saying? Any kind of flavoring that you really like can go into that salt. And, imagine lemongrass salt, a little bit of that added to pears that you're going to roast or stew, or a pear pie.
It sounds amazing. I am going to get to work. I have hours of mincing ahead of me.
Yes, and now do remember, food processors are very handy for this.
It's very relaxing.
Oh, I know it is.
And the house smells heavenly.
Exactly. But one thing that you may want to remember, if you're going to use salts that, these salts with things that are sweet, maybe change the proportion slightly. Mm-hmm, much more of the herb or the flavoring and less of the salt.
Yes, that makes sense.
Yeah. And you can just label all of those, jars or whatever saying sweet. So that you can use that anywhere, but the idea being that you'll have less salt and more flavor.
Right. Fantastic. Thank you so, so much.
You are very welcome. This is going to occupy your winter very nicely.
You bet.
Thanks, Rivke. Bye.
Bye-bye.
By the way, this is Sally Schneider, who's one of those incredibly imaginative cooks. Sally talked to us about making these seasoned salts, and it was so easy. You would take, fresh rosemary or whatever, and you can do it by hand. You can do it with a mezzaluna, one of those half moon knives, which is really easy on your hands, or you can do it in a food processor. But you take a pile of herbs, you take some coarse salt, you chop it together, and you're there. Well, we're going to be back with more of your calls, tweets, and other communiques. I'm Lynn Rossetto Casper. You're listening to The Splendid Table from APM, American Public Media. This is The Splendid Table from APM, American Public Media, the show about life's appetites. I'm Lynn Rossetto Casper. It is back to your calls. You can reach us at 800-537-5252. Follow us on Facebook and Twitter, or send us an email. Go to the website, splendidtable.org. Desmond's calling from Detroit. Desmond, what do you want to talk about?
I'm actually traveling in a couple weeks to the Mexican state of Quintana Roo, and while I know a little bit about Mexican food, I've heard that it's very different, and so I was wondering, what should I expect? And because I'm going to be there in several vacation rentals with kitchens, I was hoping to maybe try my hand at
I'm not familiar with this area. Where is it? Is it toward the south? Is it?
It's on the outside, on the Caribbean Sea, bordering Belize.
Ah, okay. Okay. First of all, there's a book you should get, okay? It's called Mexico, One Plate at a Time by Rick Bayless.
Okay.
Or Bayless. And he has spent so much time roaming Mexico, he's going to, first of all, give you a great idea of what to expect. Okay? And secondly, his recipes are really delicious, and they are authentic. And they're usually very simple. And this is one of the revelations I found going to Mexico, was that on the street, all day and late at night, you get these simple, simple tacos that are so delicious, and it's the kind of thing that you can do at home so easily. And the tacos are the size of the palm of your hand.
Okay.
And there'll be some sort of stewed meat with delicious chilies. It may or may not be super hot. Or it will be some sort of grilled fish. Or it might be vegetables. And there will be diced raw onion, just as a condiment, a few leaves of fresh coriander, and fresh lime, and maybe some chopped tomatoes, like a little fresh salsa. And that's it. And it teaches you how exquisite it is to have Mexican food that is not gloppy and loaded with cheese, because generally that's not what it's about. So you want to look for those little tacos. But the other thing, and this is the most fun, really, I think, go to the market in the morning.
Okay.
And, you know, watch what people are buying and introduce yourself. You know, learn how to say, I'm sorry, I don't speak the language as I would like to. Do you speak English? And then, if someone can help you, ask, what do you do with that you just bought? I'm learning how to cook the food here. And some people might just say, you know, I'm sorry, I don't have time. But most of the time, you end up with three or four people around you giving you cooking lessons, the likes of which no cookbook will ever give you. And don't be shy. It's a compliment to someone when you say you really want to understand their food. And if you think you can do that, I think you're going to learn a lot. But if you're very shy about doing it, Rick's book is going to help you a lot.
Oh, no, I think I can handle that.
Oh, I think you know what's going to happen, too. You may end up with some invitations to lunch, which this is not a bad
thing. That's not a bad thing either.
That exactly.
That sounds like a great plan.
Have a wonderful time, Desmond.
Thank you very much.
You're welcome.
All right. Bye-bye.
Nikki is calling from Bryan, Ohio. Hey, Nikki, where is Bryan, Ohio?
It is up in the northwest corner of Ohio.
Oh, you folks have the most beautiful leaf color at this time of year.
Oh, yes. It's gorgeous.
Oh, yes.
Beautiful weather.
Yeah. You have that stuff in the soil that they have in New England that makes the trees extra bright or whatever it is. But that aside, did you call with a question?
Yes, I did. And thank you for taking my call.
You are welcome.
I need some help with chili. My girlfriends and I have this chili competition every year, and it's an award-winning, you know, chili. You can make money off of it. But it's fun. It's for a good cause. And we want to make the best chili.
Okay. Now, this is where things get sticky. Because a lot of different parts of the country and a lot of different people define chili a little differently. So define what the ideal chili is in this situation.
Well, it's a no-bean chili. And
right.
It needs to have like a real zing at the end. But not too spicy, but just enough to take notice. There's like 300 other competitors.
Oh,
and,
brother.
Yeah.
So how do you normally do your chili?
Well, we do it over an open fire, and we do beef. And yeah, and it's a great big pot. We serve chili. It's like we make 15 gallons of it and serve it to the public, and it's all for, donations. Yeah. And we put cayenne pepper, we put tomatoes in it, we put ketchup in it, we put maple bacon oil in it.
Uh-huh. Okay, so this has a lot of really lush flavors. There's some sweet backdrop, there's tomato. What kind of meat goes into it?
Well, this year we used our own beef that we raised.
Oh, that's so you've got your own cow for your own chili.
Yes. I like this.
Mm-hmm. I like this idea of a whole customized chili. All right, and you want a bit of bite, but you want it to come at the end.
Yes, uh-huh.
Okay.
A nice taste in the beginning, and then, you know.
Well, it sounds like you've got everything going for the nice taste. I mean, you've got all these wonderful flavors playing against each other. And the cayenne is great, but, you know, one of the things about cayenne pepper is it's hot, but it's not much else. But
okay.
If you could get a hold, can you get a hold of some dried Mexican chilies?
Yeah, I think I could.
Okay. You want to use something like an ancho. Now, ancho chilies have some heat, but they're very sweet and velvety.
Okay.
All right. So you want the whole dried chili. You want a bunch of anchos. And then you want some guajillos. Now, if you find a Mexican store or a place that sells Mexican chili, these are all going to come, you know, in clear bags. And you don't want to pre-ground. You want to do that yourself for very good reason. I'll explain why in a minute.
Okay.
All right. But the guajillo has a little bit more heat, but it's still rich and big. And I would say do a small batch with these.
Okay.
Yeah, just because you want to get familiar with them.
Right.
And mm-hmm. And that's going to be a little spicier. Then hang on to the cayenne, because as you go along and taste the chili, if you want a real kick, that's what you're going to add, okay? Because these chilies are going to give you these big, round, lovely flavors. This is what you're going to do with them. You're going to take them. You can do them one of two ways. The traditional way to do it is to soak them. You soak them in hot. First of all, you put them over a burner, and you're going to use a lot of them. But you could put them in the oven. You put them on a you know, a big sheet pan or on the rack in the oven. You turn on the oven, and you lightly roast them. You're only going to give them like at 400 degrees for maybe 5 or 10 minutes. When you smell them, then you pull them out. You don't want to burn them. But you're just opening up their flavors. They go into warm water to cover for about 15 or 20 minutes. and you can have broken off the stem, and you could have taken out the seeds, but you can save the seeds if you want to, because that's where a lot of the heat is.
Okay.
And then you soak them for about 20 minutes, you drain them, and then you puree them with some garlic. So let's say for every 6 to 7 whole chilies, you're going to use 2 cloves of garlic and a teaspoon of dry oregano. And now you have a chili paste or a chili sauce, a classic one from Mexico. And this is going to be done with half ancho and half guajillo. And that's GUAJILLO.
And great.
And what you should do is do a test recipe to see how much you want of this. Mm-hmm. Taste it as you go. But once you have that puree, you could do that puree weeks ahead and put it in the freezer.
Okay, good. That was my question,
yeah,
because we travel
absolutely
down south for the chili.
Yeah, so that can travel with you, and that can be frozen, and it can be stirred into the chili. And you can stir in as much as you want as you
okay
go. But save a little for the end in case you want to have, you know, a little more rich taste of the chili at the very mm-hmm end of cooking. And then your cayenne if you really want to kick.
Mm-hmm.
Okay? So I think that's going to help you a lot.
Great. Oh, that sounds awesome. Can't wait to try it.
And I think it's great you're doing what you're doing. And boy, where is this going to happen?
It's in Atlanta.
And how many people partake? 300?
Around 300, yeah.
Good luck.
Okay, thank you.
You are welcome.
Okay.
Bye.
Bye-bye.
We have Noelle on the line from Sterling, Colorado. Noelle, what do you want to talk about?
Hi, Lynn. I grew a bunch of pumpkins in my garden this year. I decided to do the little sweet pumpkins, you know, New England.
Oh, those small little pumpkins?
Yeah, the pumpkin pie. Pumpkins, I guess they're called. So I got about 10 of them out of my little pumpkin hill, and I'm trying to think of creative things to do with them.
Right.
I just happened to see a picture on Pinterest of, like, a fondue cheese, like, baked inside of the pumpkin.
Oh, yeah.
I thought that looked like it'd be amazing. However, I try to eat mostly vegan, so
right,
fondue doesn't really work for me. So I was trying to decide something that you could bake in a pumpkin that I would want to eat.
Oh, let me count the ways. Okay, here's the deal with baking in a pumpkin.
Okay.
Just think of it as a very thick ceramic pot. It takes a while for the heat to penetrate, okay?
And
of course, you've got to scrape it out and do, you know, all of that. So I always pre-cook things and pre-cook the pumpkin and then put them together to get them hot all the way through. So I don't have to depend on that pumpkin being the cooking vessel. But take any of the stews or braised dishes that you like, you know, edamame with green beans and tofu and ginger and garlic. You see what I'm saying? Now, if you have rubbed that pumpkin with fresh ginger and a little bit of brown sugar and garlic, and you have slow baked it, now you don't want it falling apart. You just want to soften it ever so slightly. Okay, like 350 for maybe 20 minutes and test
it.
But you rub that seasoning on the inside. And then you've made whatever your favorite dish is. It could be roasted vegetables. It could be combinations, layers like, you know, saffron rice, but you really do it with turmeric because it's cheaper. And black beans and some sort of sweet peppers layered in there. Be beautiful. But the idea is...
That would be delicious.
Yeah. You get that pumpkin, you do them both ahead. And when you're going to serve, about an hour before, you heat them up together.
Oh, that sounds amazing.
Yeah, so there you go. You're
going to
use up those pumpkins faster than you can blink.
I will.
Enjoy.
Thank you so much.
You are welcome. Enjoy. 800-537-5252. Send us an email. Go to splendidtable.org. So you're heading out to dinner in Los Angeles. Well, how about bringing something extra to the experience? I mean, after all, it's the season of ghosts and odd happenings. James Bartlett has done a new guidebook. It is called Gourmet Ghosts, A Guide to Los Angeles's Haunted Bars and Restaurants and Their Ghosts, Murders, and Mysteries. James, welcome.
It's great to be here. Thank you.
So we're talking about the paranormal experience that we can have with a meal. Is this possible in many places in Los Angeles?
Well, I've managed to do about 40 or so in the book, and there are more on the website, and I found a lot more over the time that I was researching. But I tried to take a story that I either heard or spoke to somebody about and try and back it up with something perhaps from from the Los Angeles newspapers at the time to try and give it a little more, bit more sort of validity rather than just sort of like third hand, you know, they say
right,
that this place
right.
is haunted.
Well, there's one place you talk about which is still there, and it's the Roosevelt Hotel.
Yes, that's right. Very famous. The Roosevelt Hotel, which is right opposite the Grauman's Chinese Theater on Hollywood Boulevard, right on the Walk of Fame. Yes, it's been there for, what is it, 86, 87 years now. Very sophisticated, very nice hotel, very much the kind of, if you want the Hollywood experience, that's the kind of hotel that you stay in. It's beautiful inside. It has a number of bars, a number of restaurants in there. And there have been a number of stories there that are well documented.
For instance?
Well, there's the Marilyn Monroe mirror, a very large, tall, floor-to-ceiling mirror that one day that someone was looking in the mirror and they saw the image of Marilyn Monroe looking back in the mirror, and it was supposed to be the day after she had died. And the mirror was in the lobby and a number of places for years and years and years and years. It's currently in storage, or rather, well, I was told a number of stories as to where it might be, so there's a mystery with that. It's not there at the moment, but there, in the hotel there have been stories of children being heard in rooms. There's been a child seen by the fountain in the lovely lobby there. And then specifically on the ninth floor, room 928, there's been a number of reports about the sound of a bugle playing, which was supposed to be Montgomery Clift, the spirit of him. He stayed there in that room when he was doing From Here to Eternity. And, of course, he played a bugle in the movie. And he was supposed to pace up and down the corridor when he was there doing his lines and practicing his bugle. And it seems like he's still there today.
What about a restaurant that we can go to?
Well, one of the best, staying in the old school and also not too far down the road from the Roosevelt, is Musso and Frank's. Which really, that has been there forever. That actually opened before the Hollywood sign was put up, or the Hollywood Land sign, as it was originally. Now, this is very much like an old school, it's like a library, like a gentleman's club. It's not very ostentatious from the outside, because that's the whole idea. It's one of the few places in town that's always had a sort of a non-relationship with press and publicity. That you'll never see people hanging around outside. You don't get many tourists outside. And the reason is from the beginning, it's been a place where celebrities have gone. And it goes all the way back. There used to be a bookstore next door. And Bukowski and Faulkner, Hemingway and Chandler were all in the bookstore.
Oh,
yes. And then when the bookstore closed, they would all be in Musso's at the back. It has huge leather booths. A lot of them are private. Some of them are very open, depending on what you want. Orson Welles always had a very open booth. And there is a booth in there, number one, which was Charlie Chaplin's favorite booth. You can usually never get to it because people always want booth number one. It's a nice one. It's very private, has a little window view. And he's very much associated with there, and his spirit is supposed to be in the building as well.
You have a photograph in the book.
Yes, it was a photograph that somebody took when they were in the booth. And initially, you look at it and think it's nothing, and I didn't believe it at all. But if you look carefully, and it does look like there's a face. It's not necessarily Charlie Chaplin's face, but you can very much see a face, a nose, and a pair of eyes. And it's not, you know, a reflection. But, you know, I never judge in the book. I leave it up to people to make up their own minds.
Have you got one more place?
Yes, I'll give you another famous one that's also in, well, it's technically West Hollywood, is Chateau Marmont. It's a super place. It looks like it's based on a chateau in the Loire Valley in France. So it looks like a huge castle sort of perched on the side of the hill. And it's a hotel, and it's got a suites and bungalows around the side, and it's all completely covered by foliage. You can't see anything at all. There are a number of secret tunnels between some of the apartments and suites. There's supposed to be a secret tunnel from the chateau down to the boulevard where there used to be a club called Players. There are tunnels all over the city, some of them imaginary, some of them really exist, some of them I've actually sort of poked a camera down in and had a look at. Most of them are bricked up now.
Uh-huh.
But the Chateau Marmont, it's supposed to be the Hotel California by the Eagles. You know, you can check out, but you can never leave. And nearly every celebrity you've ever heard of stays, either short and long term. And John Belushi overdosed in one of the bungalows. And Boris Karloff lived there for a number of years. And there were a number of reported scary things happen while he was there. There was a woman hovering over a bed and faucets turning on and off. But it's the most discreet place, and they don't really have any stories about anything that happens, because otherwise all the people who stay there would stop staying there.
James, thank you.
Yeah, you're welcome. Thanks so much.
James Bartlett is the author of Los Angeles Gourmet Ghosts. Well, that's our show for this week. Thanks for listening. You have a great week. And until next time, let me leave you with this from Anonymous, who said, arsenic is edible, but only once. The Splendid Table is produced by APM, American Public Media. Head over to splendidtable.org for additional information on anything you heard here today. You'll find information on our latest ebooks, our weekly e-newsletter, Weeknight Kitchen, and take a look at our new podcast network, Infinite Guest. You'll find The Splendid Table there, of course, as well as a collection of other shows like Big Appetites with our producer Sally Swift and her friend Patty Hinnich of Patty's Mexican Table. Well, this week, Patty runs a triathlon with her family, and they take on stuffed vegetables big time. That's infiniteguest.org. Our show is produced by Jennifer Russell with help from Laura Kalibi. Our editor and technical director is Jennifer Lupke. Our website is managed by Andy Cruz. Our theme music was composed by Sam Keenan. Sally Swift is our managing producer. See you next week. Thanks for tuning in. I'm Lynn Rossetto-Casper, and this is APM, American Public Media.